exploration. This Moment of Science comes from Indiana University, with production support from the Brabson Foundation. Today's program was prepared by Michelle Ross, with help from Haldon Cohn in astronomy. I'm Yael Cassander.
In sports, Tampa Bay's Evan Longoria is the 2008 American League Rookie of the Year. The 23-year-old third baseman was named first on all 28 ballots cast by the Baseball Writers Association of America. Longoria is the first Rays player in the franchise's 11-year history to capture the honor. He hit .272 with 27 home runs and 85 RBIs in 122 games following an early season call-up. Chicago White Sox second baseman Alexi Ramirez was a distant runner-up after hitting .297 with 21 home runs and 77 RBIs. Chicago Cubs catcher Giovanni Soto is the National League Rookie of the Year after receiving 31 of 32 first-place votes. The other went to Cincinnati's Joey Votto. Soto hit .285 with 23 homers and 86 RBIs. Votto batted .297 with 24 homers and 84 RBIs. NFC West leader Arizona hosts San Francisco for tonight's NFL game. At 5-3, the Cardinals hold a three-game division lead over the second-place 49ers. Duke will be the first member of the AP's preseason men's basketball poll to see action. The 8th-ranked Blue Devils will host Presbyterian tonight as part of the 2K Sports Classic. Boston and Orlando put four-game winning streaks on the line during tonight's five-game NBA schedule. The defending champion Celtics are 6-1 ahead of their home game against Toronto, while the Magic bring a 4-2 mark into their outing against visiting Portland. And top-ranked Rafael Nadal says tendonitis in his right knee will keep him from participating in Spain's Davis Cup final against Argentina. The two squads will play on an indoor hard court in Spain from November 22nd through the 23rd. That's sports.
Today's programming is made possible in part by Ratio Architects, designer of the Carl Foundation's Echo Building, on the web at ratioarchitects.com.
It's 2:42. Researchers at the University of California, Berkeley, are looking for cleaner alternatives to fossil fuels, and they're doing it with funding from an oil company. One of the more promising options would be to make fuels from plant material called cellulose. As NPR's Richard Harris reports, creating the product is just the first step in a lengthy process of developing a new industry.
Berkeley's image is that of a progressive ivory tower. So it should come as no surprise that when researchers here set out to create a new industry, they wanted to make sure that it's green and socially responsible.
Here you can see the sweep of the lab.
The new Energy Biosciences Institute is trying to make at least part of our economy run on fuel from vegetation. The Institute has taken over a lab building that was once used to answer the pure scientific question of how plants convert carbon dioxide into chemical energy. Now, Christopher Somerville and his colleagues hope to exploit that chemical energy.
The best way to think about it is that if you hold a sheet of paper in your hand, that's essentially pure cellulose.
And cellulose is really nothing more than sugar molecules, glucose, all linked together with indigestible chemical bonds.
It's the principal fuel of all life on the planet, actually, glucose.
The challenge is to liberate all that energy-rich glucose from the cellulose. If it can be converted to simple sugar, it can either be fed to yeast, which will turn it into ethanol, or it can be converted chemically into liquid fuels that could directly replace diesel and gasoline. The labs to figure out how to do this are still a work in progress.
We're still unpacking crates and so on.
Your guess is as good as mine.
On this day, technicians are assembling state-of-the-art gas chromatographs, mass spectrometers, and fermentation vessels to be used by a small army of graduate students.
So this started about here.
The goal of converting plant cellulose into fuel could transform our economy with a less damaging alternative to fossil fuels. This cellulosic fuel is relatively clean because the plants that it comes from actually get their carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. So carbon cycles from the exhaust pipe into the air, back to the plants, and then to the fuel again. Producing fuel is just one step, and Somerville says he doesn't think that's going to be the hard part.
But at least 20 companies think that the technology is good enough. So when I say that no breakthroughs are necessary, I mean, this is not like fusion, for example, where, you know, it really doesn't work. This is something that works and just needs to work a bit better in order to make it really compete with fossil fuels.
We head downstairs to get a flavor for the scope of this lab.
Well, these are the instruments that we use to actually grind up the biomass.
Like a very fancy blender.
Like a very fancy blender, yeah. Okay.
Somerville's Institute is trying to develop not just a fuel, but an entire industry. And one key question is what starting ingredients to use. Many millions of acres of land would need to be planted with something if biofuels live up to their potential and replace a large fraction of gasoline in the coming decades. Somerville reaches into a cardboard box full of one prime candidate.
And this is miscanthus, so one of our favorites. You can see it looks like sort of like a little bit like bamboo in a way.
Big straw.
Or big straw, I guess that would be the that's a better way of saying it, yeah.
As far as he knows, it has no common name.
It's native to Southeast Asia, so it's been used in Japan and China for 1,000 years for thatching and also for making paper. It's a relative of sugar cane, actually. We still have a lot of questions about exactly what the best species are. In fact, there's many species that are going to be equally interesting for us. But we like this one because we get about almost 20 dry tons per year per acre with no fertilizer, no irrigation, no agrochemicals.
Somerville says we need to find a crop that will produce fuel without displacing food crops. That's where corn-based ethanol is failing and why corn is not on the menu here in Berkeley. But even non-food plants like miscanthus could be bad news if farmers decided to plant it instead of food or to cut down the rainforest to grow it.
We're only interested in it, frankly, if it can be environmentally positive and socially positive. So as we proceed with the technical innovation, we want to make sure that we understand these other dimensions and so that we can make appropriate choices, including one possible choice is that we shouldn't do this.
That's something the sponsor of this research might not want to hear. That's because this lab is funded by one of the world's largest oil companies, BP. They've committed $500 million over 10 years. At first blush, it seems strange that they're putting this technology to the test on one of the most progressive campuses in the country. But BP Vice President Paul Willem says the choice is deliberate. His office is just upstairs from Chris Somerville's.
If biofuels is going to become a big part of our company in the long run, then our view is that the only way that can be the case is that if biofuels are done in a sustainable way that, you know, clearly is good for greenhouse gas and climate change, but is also good for the environment and land use and all that sort of stuff.
And it also implies that you'd have to be prepared to, if the people here at Berkeley say, ooh, these are really insurmountable environmental problems, you ignore that at your peril.
Well, yeah, that would be a foolish thing to do as a company, basically, right? So we don't want to be building a big part of our company on a shaky foundation.
Assuming all those issues can be resolved, the blueprint for a biofuels industry is still not complete. The final piece will have to be government policies and regulations that create incentives for clean fuels. Willem says you might not think companies would actually want more regulation.
But I think generally business is very much in favor of a regulatory environment that actually is predictable. People don't like a regulatory environment which is, you know, on the left one day and on the right the next day and just flip-flops back and forth. Because it doesn't provide a context in which you can make, you know, 20 and 30 year investments.
Governments need to create that context by committing in the long run to cleaner energy sources and then sticking with that plan over the course of dozens of election cycles. Not an easy task. Berkeley professor Dan Kamen, who helped found the institute, says the long-term government policy should try to resolve two problems at once, providing energy while taking steps to slow climate change.
Certainly the ability to reduce carbon emissions has got to be front and center in that list.
Kamen is not convinced that cellulose-based biofuels will be the answer, but he says as long as we articulate our goals correctly and ramp up the funding for the research, he says people will come up with recipes for fuels that will move us around and that aren't too hard on our planet. Richard Harris, NPR News.
Wyoming. Think mountain peaks, rodeos, cowboy boots. Maybe not so much synagogues and rabbis. Fact is, there just aren't many that Jews in Wyoming, and not many resources to serve them, which makes the state an untapped market for Zalman Mendelson. NPR's Barbara Bradley Haggerty spent time with one of Wyoming's few rabbis.
When Zalman Mendelson arrived in Jackson in May, the first thing he did was open up the phone book in search of Jewish names.
And I was finding a lot of wonderful German people living over here in Jackson.
But no Jews. And finding Jews in Wyoming is the young rabbi's mission. That and bringing them the traditions of their faith. So, undeterred, Mendelson put up a website, advertised events in the Jackson newspaper, and leveraged his most dramatic asset, his appearance.
I'm a walking advertisement for Judaism.
Mendelson wears a black suit, a black skullcap, and a full black beard. He's straight out of Central Casting, Warsaw rabbi, circa 1935. But Mendelson is only 26. He and his 21-year-old wife, Razi, are emissaries in the Chabad movement, in which young Orthodox Jews move to remote areas armed with their faith and rituals. What they found in this resort town, he says, is material wealth and spiritual hunger.
The soul wants godliness. The soul wants holiness. The soul wants Shabbos. The soul wants Torah. The soul wants doing kindness and goodness and mitzvahs.
And Mendelssohn's passion is to fulfill those spiritual needs. He provided Friday night services and Sabbath dinners. He brought in skullcaps and scrolls for doors called mezuzahs.
These are all things that became available all of a sudden that weren't here before.
Mendelson knows it's fine to offer these things, but unless people want to embrace their Jewish faith, all his efforts are meaningless. So he's trying to revive a yearning for Jewish spirituality and community, and he and Razi are doing it one challah at a time.
So this is just the way I package them, since I don't have a professional machine or any of that stuff.
Razi Mendelson slips 5 braided loaves of bread into Ziploc bags.
And then I'm going to put a label on the front. Zalman and Razi Mendelson wish you a tasty and peaceful Shabbos.
They call it 21st century rabbinic marketing. Every Friday morning, Zalman drops by the house of an unsuspecting Jew, fresh challah in hand.
Hello there. How are you, Reuben?
Come on in.
Thank you.
Reuben Tambor is one of the 500 or so Jews who live in Jackson year-round. Mendelson has come before. Tambor has always been cordial, nothing more, until today.
Somebody asked me if I knew a rabbi. Believe it or not. And
wow.
I wrote down the name.
I appreciate that, Reuben.
Tambor writes down the name and number and happily takes the challah.
Sure.
The two men chat, and before he wears out his welcome, the rabbi leaves for his next delivery. In the car, he breaks out in a grin.
This is the way it works. This is how we network, and I've been doing this for so many years, and it works.
And he's in it for the long haul.
This is a lifelong campaign. Doesn't stop after I've found 50 Jews. Doesn't stop after I found 100 Jews. It doesn't stop. It doesn't end. The campaign continues. Hello?
The rabbi's BlackBerry buzzes. It's a man who's vacationing with his family in the Tetons and read about Shabbat services on the website.
Shabbat lunch. You're welcome to join us for that. And we'll be starting at around 12:30 lunch.
That's wonderful. Thank you.
Mendelson gives directions to his home, then turns to me.
Barb, I'm not kidding at all. Every half hour, we get a phone call, an email, nonstop.
All this in just 3 months since settling in Jackson.
We're going to get started. Shalom, one and all.
About 30 people are milling around a hotel conference room in Jackson. It's the first Meet the Rabbi open house. After Mendelson introduces himself and explains his mission, he opens the floor.
Kat's question was, what is Chabad? It's a fantastic question.
More questions keep coming. What are your plans for Jackson? What kinds of classes do you teach? Do I have to be Orthodox to attend? Afterwards, over cookies and cake, several people say they appreciate the Mendelsons reviving Jewish traditions in Jackson. Karen McQuillan is one of them.
It's very hard to live an observant life. There are a lot of sacrifices involved. Without people like Zalman and Razi, Judaism would disappear.
The Chabad rabbi is not the rabbi of Jackson Hole.
Lisa Finkelstein did not attend the open house. She serves on the board of Jackson Hole Jewish Community, a group of mainly Reform Jews that's been around for 30 years. She doesn't like Mendelssohn's style.
He contacts people on the phone, by their email, in parking lots. And we don't necessarily do that.
Nor are most Jews in the area as conservative as Mendelssohn's. Zalman always wears a yarmulke and declines to shake hands with women. Razi wears long skirts and spends much of her time cooking. The rabbi says they aren't out to convert people to Orthodox Judaism. But Jewish community board member Rachel Ravitz worries that the Mendelssohns may give people the wrong impression.
People in Wyoming might not necessarily know what a Jew is in the first place. And if they meet a Chabad rabbi, may not realize that he represents a certain sect of Judaism.
But the big problem, several people say privately, is competition. The new rabbi's outreach programs cost $11,000 to $12,000 a month, and if people start attending his congregation, their money will follow. But Razi Mendelssohn says having competition is a healthy thing.
It's kind of like, you know, when you have one store and then another store opens up, the first store is all mad, but the people are very happy because they get better bargains and better deals and they get more variety.
She's echoing the findings of sociologists who say that religions thrive in the United States precisely because they compete in the marketplace of ideas. And the Mendelssohns are grabbing market share, judging from the growing numbers coming to Shabbat dinner.
I've made two different types of gefilte fish. So that's for my first course. My second course is always chicken soup.
Razi is putting the finishing touches on tonight's meal. She laughs as she remembers their early days.
And our first week, we had one woman come, and she sat there through the whole service. And I said to Zalman, you know, in a couple years, she'll be telling people, when the rabbi started, I was the only one that came to services. And now look at how many people there are.
We'll start off with a short prayer. May he who blessed our fathers...
A few minutes later, 11 people gather around the formal table, laden with food and wine. And it is this moment, this is the reason for all the planning and marketing and technology, bringing Jews back to Shabbat, to their community, and to the traditions that many of them have forgotten. Barbara Bradley Haggerty, NPR News.
Programming on WILL AM is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting audiences to experience the Dresden Staatskapelle on November 15th, as well as the Takacs Quartet, Muzsikash, and Marta Sebastian on November 19th. For more information, visit KrannertCenter.com.
Earth and sky.
The giant Oolacca clouds are light years in size. And so they're so large, they sort of boggle the mind.
You're listening to astronomer Ted Bergen of the University of Michigan. He's talking about huge clouds of molecules in space that collapse to form thousands of stars and planets.
So we know we're seeing CO, and we know we're seeing methanol, we know we're detecting alcohol in space, and most importantly, water.
As a gas cloud in space collapses under its own weight, Bergen said that hydrogen and oxygen molecules combine and freeze as water ice on grains of dust.